My name is David Cohen, and I'm from the Cornell Civil Liberties Union. And on behalf of the Civil Liberties Union, the Women's Law Coalition, Gay PAC, Gay and Lesbian Advocates, National Lawyers Guild, and the Public Interest Law Union, I'd like to welcome you here tonight. Mr. Thomas Stoddard is going to speak on gay rights in general in America today, both at the federal and state level. At the end of his talk, he'll entertain questions about the particular applications to the Cornell situation. Mr. Stoddard is currently the legislative director of the NYCLU. He practices law in New York City and teaches at New York University Law School, where he teaches a course on gay rights, which is the only course on that topic in any law school in the country. He's published a book called The Rights of Gay People, put out by the American Civil Liberties Union. You can order through our group or straight from the Civil Liberties Union if you like. And one other plug, the Civil Liberties Union came out with a paper today that we have a whole batch of out back. You can pick one up and take it home and read it at your leisure. There'll be a reception following Mr. Stoddard's talk in the foyer. That way, just follow the crowd. Don't exactly know how to get there. I'd like to welcome Mr. Thomas Stoddard.
I hope my voice is coming across here. I can't tell, the room is too large. Is it all right? Yes? No?
Yes.
Good. Thank you for the kind introduction, Dave. I hope you will indulge me for a minute because I really want to start out on a personal note. In coming to Cornell today, I was reminded of my own years in college. I entered college in 1966, and in purely chronological terms, that's not a very long time ago. But in terms of spirit and history, certainly in regard to gay rights, it is a very long time ago. It seems very distant. And in fact, I suspect by looking at most of you that you don't remember very much about 1966. So please indulge me for a minute and let me reminisce a bit about what it was like for me to be in college 15 years ago or so. I did enter college in 66. I went to Georgetown University, which you may have heard of. Specifically, I went to the School of Foreign Service, which is probably best known now because it gave Jean Kirkpatrick to the United Nations. And frankly, I hope that she might stay there. But at any rate, Georgetown was then and still is in Washington, D.C. And my arrival at Georgetown at age 18 was my first entry into the adult world, as it is for most people who go to college. At that time in my life, like most people who are 18 years old, I thought a lot about sex and I thought a lot about sexuality. But also, like most 18-year-olds, I didn't know exactly who I was and I didn't know what I wanted out of my life. In fact, it took me quite some time to figure those things out, insofar as I already have. But I did know that I had some thoughts and some sentiments that were out of the ordinary. I remember, for example, going to bookstores in Washington, D.C. to look at books on the subject of homosexuality, something about which I knew nothing and was afraid to ask anyone else about. In fact, I was so afraid when I went to the bookstore that I couldn't buy the books. I was afraid somehow the cashier would figure out who I was and report back to somebody. I didn't know who, but I always thought it was a possibility, so I would just go into a dark corner in the bookstore and find the book and hold it down so no one could see the cover, and then I'd start reading until somebody else started to come into the room and approach me, and then I would put the book back and walk away. I also found myself taking frequent strolls down a street in Washington called O Street, and I didn't know very much about what O Street was like, except that I had been told that that's where gay people met. So I would walk down the street and try to figure out who was gay and who wasn't. And if anyone approached me, I would, of course, cross the street and walk away. And that was the extent of my gay experiences at Georgetown. I kept my forbidden thoughts to myself, totally. I spoke to no one about them, and I took great pains to make sure that no one would know what those thoughts were or who I really was and what I really might be thinking. I never thought of myself as a homosexual. And I used the word homosexual with some care because the word gay did not exist for me, as it did not exist for most people in 1966. And I just thought of myself as someone with a certain perverse turn of mind, a turn of mind that I found difficult to control, despite my best efforts at personal discipline. You may know, I hope you know, the wonderful novel Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. And it begins with a very moving paragraph. Ellison wrote, and this book was written in 1947, written by a black man about the experience of growing up as a black man in the South, began as follows. I am an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe. Nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I had been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imaginations, indeed everything and anything except me. I was Ellison's invisible man, with an extra twist. I was invisible even to myself. I could not see my own image. I could not recognize my own feelings. I was invisible to myself, and also, of course, to others, because at that time and at that place, Washington, D.C. in 1966, the subject of homosexuality was unspeakable. It was forbidden. It was unacceptable. Some of you in this audience, maybe even most of you at this point, really are too young to have known what the world was like at that time. But as to this particular issue, it was radically different. There was no gay rights movement. There were no gay newspapers. There was no Phil Donahue show to talk about what being gay was like. There was no gay pack. There was nothing. For some Americans, there was no such thing as homosexuality itself. One very dear friend of mine, who is a contemporary in age, tells me that her mother, who is a well-educated, upper-middle-class woman, now living, and I guess before living too, in suburban Syracuse, never knew that there was such a thing as homosexuality or homosexuals until she was 40 years old. And she was shocked. Such ignorance is no longer possible, even with the greatest diligence. Virtually every adult American, as well as most children over the age of 5, and some younger than 5, know the words gay and lesbian. They know that millions of American men and women identify themselves with those labels. And they know that there is a gay rights movement, if only because Anita Bryant and Jerry Falwell told them so. They've probably done more to bring the movement to full recognition than all the advocates in the world. Now, I ask myself, because I really don't know the answer, how is such a change possible in the span of 15 years? What is it that brought about this monumental change in public perception? It's a question that is more properly addressed to an historian or a sociologist and not a humble lawyer like me. But it would seem to have something to do with the crucible of social change that was the 1960s, with its new ideas about the role of women, about sexual behavior, and about individual rights in general. I can't tell you precisely how and why those changes took place, but I can tell you about the revolution in the law that has taken place over the intervening 15 years, and that is what I will do now. Before 1970, the law treated gay people, insofar as it could identify them at all, as either criminals or pariahs. And let me give you two noteworthy examples. On January 8, 1962, a grand jury in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, jointly indicted one Max Doyle Perkins and one Robert Eugene McCorkle on the charge that they, and this is quoting literally from the indictment, did unlawfully, willfully, maliciously, and feloniously commit the abominable and detestable crime against nature with each other. That's an end quote. Their alleged crime against nature had been a consensual act of fellatio. Under the laws of North Carolina at the time, remember, 1964, 2 years before I went to Georgetown, the punishment for such a crime against nature was imprisonment for not less than 5, nor more than 60 years. By contrast, in North Carolina at that time, the maximum punishment for second-degree murder was 30 years. This punishment may seem extreme. It obviously is extreme. But it represented, even at the time, a considerable improvement over the original sentence in North Carolina for a crime against nature, which was death. At any rate, the two defendants responded differently to their joint accusation. McCorkle pled no contest, and he received a relatively lenient sentence, 5 to 7 years. Perkins, on the other hand, entered a plea of not guilty and was tried by a jury of his peers, which found him guilty. He received a sentence of not less than 20, nor more than 30 years, 1964. The judge who sentenced him was the very same judge who had sentenced McCorkle. Perkins appealed his conviction and sentence to the Superior Court of North Carolina. His petition was denied. He then commenced what's called a habeas corpus proceeding in federal court, alleging several constitutional defects in the state court proceedings. He claimed, among other things, that his sentence was so excessive that it constituted cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. He also contended that his lawyer had not been afforded enough time before the trial to prepare an adequate defense. In fact, that was totally correct. The trial court had appointed his lawyer at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon, and the trial began at 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning. The federal judge totally rejected Perkins' argument that his sentence was unconstitutionally severe. There was a valid reason for the disparity in sentences between McCorkle and Perkins, he said. The two defendants were different, he said, because they were different in background and in previous homosexual conduct. And that's the judge's quote. By that, the judge apparently meant that Perkins was an avowed homosexual with considerable experience. But the judge did buy Perkins' right to counsel argument. He made it clear that he did not want to keep Perkins in jail, and in fact, he let him go. But please listen to what the judge had to say in so doing. 1964, North Carolina, Federal District Court. Putting Perkins into the North Carolina prison system is a little like throwing Brer Rabbit into the briar patch. Most doctors who have studied homosexuality agree that the prison environment, including close, continuous, and exclusive contact with other men, aggravates and strengthens homosexual tendencies and provides unexcelled opportunity for homosexual practices. For the confirmed homosexual, imprisonment can accomplish no rehabilitative function. Instead, it provides an outlet for the gratification of sexually deviant desires. In other words, these are my words, gay people are sexually obsessed, rapacious creatures who will stop at nothing to satisfy their perverse appetites. They will even overlook the severe indignities of prison life if they can be afforded close, continuous, and exclusive, end quote, sexual contact with their fellow inmates. The criminal law was only one of the instruments of oppression. There were other ways to punish and subjugate. Between 1950 and 1955, as I hope you know, the federal government conducted a systematic purge of its employees suspected of subversive activities or inclinations. That period and that purge are still well remembered in books like Scoundrel Time and Naming Names and in movies like The Front. But what is less remembered is that the purge touched not only those with unorthodox political views, it also touched, in a very serious and sinister way, gay people. On April 19, 1950, the venerable New York Times carried a news story with the headline, "Perverts Called Government Peril," and it read in substantial part as follows, again, 1950, approximately 30 years ago. Guy George Gabrielson, Republican National Chairman, asserted today that sexual perverts who have infiltrated our government in recent years were perhaps as dangerous as the actual communists. He elevated what he called the homosexual angle to the national political level in his first newsletter of 1950, addressed to about 7,000 party workers under the heading, "This is the News from Washington." Giving National Committee support to the campaign of Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin, against the State Department, but without mentioning him by name, Mr. Gabrielson said, "Perhaps as dangerous as the actual communists are the sexual perverts who have infiltrated our government in recent years. The State Department has confessed that it has had to fire 91 of these. It is the talk of Washington and of the Washington Correspondence Corps. The country would be more aroused over this tragic angle of the situation if it were not for the difficulties of the newspapers and radio commentators in adequately presenting the facts while respecting the decency of their American audiences." Which is to say, you can't talk about sex in the newspapers in 1950. For 5 years, the federal government waged a campaign to rout out gay men and lesbians from government service, particularly in the State Department, the intelligence agencies, and the military. The government's campaign destroyed thousands of careers. It served to brand thousands of loyal, hardworking citizens as simultaneously seditious and sick. In some cases, it even destroyed lives. In some cases, it led to suicide. But that time is over now. 1950 is not 1983. We have seen astonishing progress in the law since the time of the purges. With respect to gay people, the progress in the law has been threefold. And let me give you some sense of that now. First, over half the states have now decriminalized homosexual sex acts, including the so-called crime against nature of Max Doyle Perkins and Robert Eugene McCorkle. That does not include, by the way, North Carolina, which still makes it a felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. Illinois, my home state, led the way in 1962. It enacted a new penal code that, for the first time in American history, omitted provisions against all consensual, non-commercial, private sex acts between adults, including homosexual acts. Between 1971 and 1983, 22 states followed the example of the Prairie State and voluntarily eliminated their consensual sodomy statutes from their penal codes. In addition, courts in three other states, Pennsylvania, Texas, and our own state of New York, have nullified consensual sodomy statutes on the basis of constitutional grounds. Thus, a total of 26 have now reformed their criminal laws to permit consensual sexual acts between people of the same gender. Within the boundaries of those 26 states live the vast majority of the American people. The list includes, for example, the five biggest states in the country. This change amounts to nothing less than a revolution in the law. In the space of only 2 decades, America has liberated a majority of its gay men and women from the oppression of the criminal law. The second path of reform concerns federal employment. In 1969, a federal appellate court in Washington, D.C. ruled that the U.S. government could not dismiss a civil service employee merely because he had engaged in a homosexual act. The court declared that the government would have to show that the employee's private conduct somehow impaired his ability to do his job or impaired the functioning of the agency in some concrete fashion. In subsequent years, this ruling has become a beacon to other courts. The name of the case, by the way, is Norton v. Macy. Those other courts have followed the daring lead of Judge Bazelon in Norton v. Macy and have agreed with his assertion that homosexuality per se is not enough to deny a government worker his or her job. Eventually, the federal government itself adopted this rule of law, and it now applies in the entire federal civil service. It is now a well-established rule throughout the federal government, with some exceptions, that a gay person may not be dismissed on the grounds of homosexuality alone. Unfortunately, there are exceptions to the rule, and still exempt from it are the intelligence agencies and the military. But I do have the faith that they too will eventually succumb to rational thought through the pressures of continued litigation, if that's necessary. The third principal reform is one that is already familiar to you, I hope. Since 1970, more than 50 municipalities across the country have adopted affirmative legislation shielding gay men and women from discrimination in the private sector. One state, Wisconsin, has done it statewide. Every time a new jurisdiction enacts protective laws for gay people, it creates a precedent in favor of such legislation in other jurisdictions that have not yet acted. I fully expect that a day will come when such protective legislation is universal throughout the United States, as is general civil rights legislation now. The pattern is clear, I think, at this point, and I also believe that the process is inexorable, and the state of Wisconsin is the best example of that. I hope I'm not being naive about this, and I hope that I'm not proven wrong. I think I won't be. The struggle for civil rights for gay people is firmly within the best political traditions of the United States. It is grounded in and inspired by the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, and it reflects the best that is in all of us, man or woman, black or white, gay or straight. I turn again to Invisible Man. In the last few pages of the novel, Ellison writes, "Diversity is the word. Let man," and I would add my own parenthetical, word, "woman, keep his or her many parts, and you'll have no tyrant states. America is woven of many strands. I would recognize them and let it so remain. Our fate is to become one, and yet many. That is not prophecy, but description. Gay men and women are part of our national fabric. Their cause will prevail. That is not prophecy either, it is description." Thank you very much. If you have questions, I'd be glad to answer them insofar as time permits. Yes, also if I can hear. Should I repeat the question so you can hear it? The question is how the government justifies the exception that now exists for the intelligence agencies and for the military, and also how that would be subject to attack in the courts, presumably. The government uses the same rationale that it used during the McCarthy era, that people who are out of the ordinary, people who have something to be embarrassed about, are subject to blackmail. Also that they are inherently reliable. At least that's the argument that's used in the intelligence agencies. The military uses an additional argument, which is that military people have to work and live in very close contact with one another, and they are sexually segregated, and that the close proximity of people of the same sex does not lend itself to homosexuality, and that other service members will be embarrassed and disturbed to have gay people in their midst. Those arguments have been accepted so far by the courts. In fact, a high appellate court, federal appellate court, accepted those arguments, including the latter argument, in 1980, in the only high court opinion to date dealing with the constitutionality of the military's exclusionary policy. I don't know how soon it will take to attack those successfully. I think that they are inevitably losing arguments because they are the same arguments that could have been used to exclude women or to exclude blacks. And I think that will eventually be seen by the judges who have to deal with those issues, although the issue may have to be presented to them again and again and again. John Stuart Mill said that every great movement, every great social movement, goes through three stages: ridicule, discussion, and acceptance. We are passing, those of us who are gay, from the stage of ridicule to the stage of discussion. I personally thought it was impossible to happen within my lifetime. I had known so much unhappiness when I was in college. But it is happening, and I think it inevitably will lead to the fall of all of those kinds of arbitrary exclusions, because they are arbitrary, they are not rational. And if you read the appellate court decisions, they just don't make legal sense. They really don't. I don't think it's my bias. They just don't square with other civil rights opinions dealing with other minorities and other issues of civil rights. But I could be proven wrong on that too. Yes?
In your opinion, is it possible for Cornell to adhere to some kind of policy of non-discrimination without there being
The question is whether Cornell can, and I don't know what you mean by can.
If it's not written to law within jurisdiction,
right.
Can it be binding?
Okay, the question is, can Cornell propound and follow anti-discrimination provisions that are broader than those in legal jurisdictions, in the local community or in the state of New York? And the answer is clearly yes. Any private entity has the right to adopt its own policies and to follow those policies. And those policies can even be actionable in court insofar as they are made known to people who rely upon them. No question that they can do that. That can even be done within the government. For example, Mayor Koch in New York issued an executive order in 1978 that prohibits city government from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. There is no legislative basis for that executive order other than the Bill of Rights, other than the Constitution. And yet he clearly has that right. And there's no one to date who has questioned a governor's ability to propound executive orders that simply enforce general constitutional rights. Private citizens have that right all the time. And Cornell is, of course, a private citizen in this regard. Actionable in court? It's hard to speak in without knowing fully how he would explain himself, although I've seen some documents. But I, on the basis of what you have said, I would not agree with that interpretation. Yes? The question is whether the Supreme Court will consider the issue of immigration in the gay context. Immigration law strictly prohibits the entry of homosexuals into the United States. And I don't mean just to live, I mean to visit. If you are an alien and you try to enter the United States and you say or happen to indicate that you are gay, you must be excluded from the United States. At least that is what the law says, and the Supreme Court 20 years ago upheld that. There is recent case law in the lower federal courts that indicates that the Supreme Court's decision and the statute are no longer enforceable. It's basically grounded on medical developments since that time that indicate that homosexuality is not a disease. Whether the Supreme Court will grant cert in those questions, I don't know. I think not. I think that there will have to be more development of case law below before the court does, but the court has done things that are more mysterious than that. Let me mention to you that there is a very important case pending in the Supreme Court right now dealing with gay rights. It may be the most important gay rights case ever to be considered by the Supreme Court, and it arises from New York, so you should be particularly aware of it. It is a case called People versus Uplinger. Let me tell you a little about it now. In 1980, the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York, struck down New York's consensual sodomy statute, saying that it invaded the right to privacy. Viewed as a great victory by gay people in New York and also by civil libertarians who care generally about the right to privacy. And the district attorney then asked the Supreme Court to consider the case. The Supreme Court declined, for reasons that are unclear, but we were all very glad because it didn't give the court an opportunity to overrule the Court of Appeals. 2 years later, this spring, the New York Court of Appeals considered another case, an analogous case, called People versus Uplinger. That case dealt with a statute, state statute, that prohibits solicitation in public for the purpose of deviant sexual intercourse. I wonder how many of you realize that that was against the law in New York. The Court of Appeals said, in essence, in a very short opinion, this is a companion statute to the statute we struck down in People versus Uplinger. It burdens a privacy right, and we declare it unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution. The district attorney then appealed that case to the Supreme Court, And I, among other people, thought, well, of course the Supreme Court won't consider this. They didn't consider the issue of People versus Onofre. But the Supreme Court fooled me, as it has done several times over the past decade. It took the case. And briefs are due by the people who represent the defendants this month. There will be oral argument before the Supreme Court on the privacy issues of consensual sodomy, perhaps for the first time ever. I don't know what the Supreme Court will do with that issue. I am pessimistic if the Supreme Court does, in fact, deal with the underlying privacy issues. But you should watch the newspapers carefully around June or July and see what the Supreme Court ultimately does do with that case. It could have a very great effect upon the whole movement for gay rights in the United States. Any other questions? Yes. They have a, their lawyer, you raise a difficult legal issue because the issue of whether a Supreme Court decision will apply retroactively differs from case to case. And it might be necessary eventually to go to the Supreme Court on that issue and ask the court that question and have it rule definitively. I would argue that that those people were improperly imprisoned, and their lawyers would certainly do that on the basis of the new case as well. But there have been cases where the Supreme Court has declared that a new constitutional rule does not apply retroactively. So it's not absolutely clear. Yes?
Is there any litigation going on about gay civil marriages?
About gay?
Civil marriages?
There have been, so far, 3 attempts in the courts to challenge a refusal to grant a marriage license to a same-sex couple. All have been without results. In fact, spectacularly so. It's my own feeling that litigation on that issue will not be successful until the society comes to understand the gay issue better. And I'm sure that the Supreme Court is not ready to deal with that kind of an issue. Yes?
Going back to the question about the CIA discriminating against gay people, I remember one case, one of the first ones we really did a headline, when a guy was fired and he struck back saying, I am not blackmailable, as you may think, if you come up to my family and my friends. I think he was reinstated, and I think they had to buy that. So
you may be talking about some of the security clearance cases, which are different. That may be. Let me give you an example of a case that I'm aware of involving a security clearance. If you work at a high level in the federal government, you have to get a security clearance to do your job. In some cases, if you work for a defense contractor or another entity that enters into a contract with the federal government, you also have to get a security clearance to do your job. And there have been a number of recent cases concerning not so much government employees, but employees of those private contractors. In one case, in California, a man who worked for a private contractor challenged the Army's denial of a security clearance to him. And he said, he used exactly the argument that you raised, I am not blackmailable because everybody knows I'm gay. My parents know I'm gay. I am open to everybody. I have nothing to be ashamed of. There's nothing that I can be held accountable to by a foreign agent. He also said, I live in a state where it is not against the law to engage in consensual homosexual acts, California. The Army settled the case on that basis, feeling that they could not win. And that does establish a precedent that can be used in other cases, including the military cases and the intelligence agency cases.
So as far as you know, there's no precedent within the CIA?
I know of no precedent within the CIA and the FBI. And one of the problems in these particular areas is that the military, the intelligence agencies, and the immigration laws are things apart. They are viewed by the courts as extraordinary situations where the power of the government is far greater than it would be as against ordinary citizens in ordinary situations. And that's why it's so hard to fight in those instances. In immigration, for example, the case law is clear that Congress has what's called plenary power to deal with immigration. And to some degree, I read plenary power to mean that there are no constitutional rights. and that's also been so in the military area. Rights that exist in the world in general do not exist for people who belong to the military, and the general explanation is military life is different. It requires a special kind of discipline, a special kind of spirit, and therefore there must be more homogeneity. I don't buy that argument. I think it's very dangerous. That's right. That's one of the best arguments to use. It's not a matter of trying to exclude gay people in the future. It's that they've always been there. There is a fascinating case in Washington State involving a man who has been in the military, I believe it's the Air Force, for 15 years. He entered in the Vietnam era when he was encouraged to enter by the government. But when he came to the question on his form when he first entered, are you a homosexual or do you have homosexual tendencies, he checked yes. But it didn't matter to the government because they wanted soldiers those days. It only mattered in 1982 when he reapplied for enlistment. And then they went back and they said, but you checked this box 15 years ago and we have a strict military policy against homosexuals and we're going to throw you out. And he said, you can't do that. I've relied on this. I've built a career on my military service, and you allowed me to do that. You can't now destroy my life for me. And the federal district court judge said that he was right. That the government, even despite its exclusionary policy, cannot induce someone into a certain posture for 15 years and then suddenly turn around and change its posture to his detriment. And so there are all sorts of clever legal theories that can be used to whittle away at basic principles. And eventually, of course, those exceptions can swallow the rule, can destroy the rule. Other questions? Yes?
Where do you see the ROTC programs going as far as the military recruitment issue at the various campuses?
That's too broad a question. Can you narrow it down? Are you suggesting that it helps to undermine the military policy by having private citizens express the point of view that it's wrong and taking steps like, for example, excluding the military from recruitment? Is that what you're saying?
Is that helpful? I'm saying something that's happening in the courts now. Recently, one of the campuses that has brought the issue up.
There is no litigation on it now. And the litigation on the military question itself has been discouraging so far, with a few exceptions like the Washington case I just mentioned. So you're going to have to do it without the court's help. Yes?
A friend of mine who's from Maine told me that there was a female in the last program at the University of Maine in Orlando who asked to be excused from girlfriends one time to go to a gay rights rally and was kicked out of class just for asking for that. As far as I know, is that within the military policy?
The military policy is extraordinary. Policy begins with a statement, homosexuality is totally incompatible with military service. It then goes on to say that you fall within the forbidden category if you have homosexual thoughts, even if you never do anything about them. So the policy would say yes. I think the courts would say the military can't do that. As unusual as the military is, it cannot go that far. It cannot tell you what to think in all circumstances. It can't control your emotions or your glands. In fact, there is one federal district court case that holds to that effect. A woman was denied reenlistment because she admitted having homosexual emotions, emotions about which she had done nothing in particular. She had never had a homosexual contact or relationship. And the court said to the military, you can't go this far, because to do so is to undermine personal integrity to such a degree that it suggests a totalitarian state. That's only one federal district court, and it was in Wisconsin, and the military still insists that it will throw out people who have bad thoughts. But I don't know what will happen exactly. Yes. Right.
Is that still being held by the Air Force, or is she pursuing any civil?
It is on appeal, as I understand it, to federal, to the U.S. Court of Military Appeals.
Okay, so the military case still, she's not taking any civil action. She can't.
I believe that she cannot until the military appeals are exhausted.
Okay.
Ordinarily, that's the case.
Okay.